Chapter 21. Causality. As flies to wanton boys, are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport. From Shakespeare's King Lear. Act 4, Scene 1, line 36. Who is all-powerful should fear everything. Pierre Corneille, Sinner, 1640, Act 4, Scene 2. They were overjoyed to be back. They whooped it up, giddy with excitement. They climbed over the chairs. They hugged and patted one another on the back. All of them were close to tears. They had succeeded. But not only that, they had returned, safely negotiating all the tunnels. Abruptly, amidst a hail of static, the radio began blaring out the machine status report. All three Benzels were decelerating. The built-up electrical charge was dissipating. From the commentary, it was clear that Project had no idea of what had happened. Ellie wondered how much time had passed. She glanced at her watch. It had been a day at least, which would bring them well into the year 2000. Appropriate enough. Oh, wait till they hear what we have to tell them, she thought. Reassuringly, she patted the compartment where the dozens of video microcassettes were stored. How the world would change when these films were released. The space between and around the Benzels had been repressurized. The airlock doors were being opened. Now there were radio inquiries about their well-being. Oh, we're fine, she shouted back into a microphone. Let's out. You won't believe what happened to us. The five emerged from the airlock, happy, effusively greeting their comrades who had helped build and operate the machine. The Japanese technicians saluted them. Project officials surged towards them. Devi said quietly to Ellie, as far as I can tell, everyone's wearing exactly the same clothing they did yesterday. Look at that ghastly yellow tie on Peter Valerian. Oh, he wears that old thing all the time, Ellie replied. His wife gave it to him. The clocks read 15:20. Activation had occurred close to 3 o'clock the previous afternoon, so they had been gone just a little over 24. What day is it? She asked. They looked at her uncomprehendingly. Something was wrong. Peter, for heaven's sake, what day is it? Well, how do you mean? Valerian answered. It's today, Friday, December the 31st, 1999. It's New Year's Eve. Is that what you mean, Ellie? Are you all right? Vege was telling Arkangelsky to let him begin at the beginning, but only after his cigarettes were produced. Project officials and representatives of the machine consortium were converging around them. She saw Dehir wedging his way to her through the crowd. From your perspective, what happened? She asked as finally he came within conversational range. Oh, nothing. The vacuum system worked, the Benzels spun up, they accumulated quite an electrical charge. They reached the prescribed speed, and then everything reversed. What do you mean, everything reversed? The Benzel slowed down. The charge dissipated. The system was repressurized. The Benzel stopped, and all of you came out. The whole thing took maybe 20 minutes. We couldn't talk to you while the Benzels were spinning. Did you experience anything at all? She laughed. Oh, Ken, my boy, she said, have I got a story for you? There was a party for project personnel to celebrate machine activation and the momentous new year. Ellie and her travelling companions did not attend. The television stations were full of celebrations, parades, exhibits, retrospectives, prognostications, and optimistic addresses by national leaders. She caught a glimpse of remarks by the Abbot Utsumi, beatific as ever. But she could not dawdle. Project Directorate had quickly concluded, from the fragments of their adventures, that the five had time to recount that something had gone wrong. They found themselves hustled away from the milling crowds of government and consortium officials for a preliminary interrogation. It was thought prudent, project officials explained, for each of the five to be questioned separately. Dehir and Valerian conducted her debriefing in a small conference room. There were other project officials present, including Vege's former student, Anatoly Goldman. She understood that Bobby Bui, who spoke Russian, was sitting in for the Americans during Vege's interrogation. They listened, politely, and Peter was encouraging now and again, but they had difficulty understanding the sequence of events. Much of what she related somehow worried them. Her excitement was non-contagious. It was hard for them to grasp that the dodecahedron had been gone for 20 minutes, much less a day, because the armada of instruments exterior to the Benzels had filmed and recorded the event and reported nothing extraordinary. All that had happened, Valerian explained, was that the Benzels had reached their prescribed speed. Several instruments of unknown purpose had the equivalent of their needles move. The Benzels slowed down and stopped, and the five emerged in a state of great excitement. He didn't exactly say babbling nonsense, but she could sense his concern. They treated her with deference, but she knew what they were thinking. The only function of the machine was, in 20 minutes, to produce a memorable illusion, or, just possibly, to drive the five of them mad. She played back the video microcassettes for them, each carefully labelled Vega Ring System, for example, or Vega Radio Facility, Quintuple System, Galactic Center Starscape, and one bearing the inscription Beach. She inserted them in play mode, one after the other. They had nothing on them. The cassettes were blank. She couldn't understand what had gone wrong. She had carefully learned the operation of the video microcamera system and had used it successfully in tests before machine activation. She'd even done a spot check on some of the footage after they'd left the Vega system. She was further devastated later when she was told that the instruments carried by the others had also somehow failed. Peter Valerian wanted to believe her, Dehir also, but it was hard for them, even with the best will in the world. The story that the five had come back with was a little, well, unexpected, and entirely unsupported by physical evidence. Also, there just hadn't been enough time. They had been out of sight for only 20 minutes. This was not the reception that she had expected. But she was confident it would all sort itself out. For the moment, she was content to play the experience back in her mind and make some detailed notes. She wanted to be sure that she would forget nothing. Although a front of extremely cold air was moving in from Kamchatka, it was still unseasonably warm when, late on New Year's Day, a number of unscheduled flights arrived at Sapporo International Airport. The new American Secretary of Defense, Michael Kitts, and a team of hastily gathered experts arrived in an airplane marked the United States of America. Their presence was confirmed by Washington only when the story was about to break on Hokkaido. The terse press release noted that the visit was routine, that there was no crisis, no danger, and that nothing extraordinary has been reported at the machine systems integration. A Tu-120 had flown overnight from Moscow, carrying, among others, Stefan Baruda and Timofey Gottsridge. Doubtless, neither group was delighted to spend this New Year's holiday away from their families, but the weather in Hokkaido was a pleasant surprise. It was so warm that the sculptures in Sapporo were melting, and the dodecahedron of ice had become an almost featureless small glacier, the water dripping off rounded surfaces that had once been the edges of the pentagonal surfaces. 2 days later, a severe winter storm struck, and all traffic into the machine facility, even by four-wheel drive vehicles, was interrupted. Some radio and all television links were severed. Apparently, a microwave relay tower had been blown down. During most of the new interrogations, the only communication with the outside world was by telephone, and, just conceivably, Ellie thought, by dodecahedron. She was tempted to steal herself on board and spin up the Benzels. She enjoyed elaborating on this fantasy, but, in fact, there was no way to know whether the machine would ever work again, at least from this side of the tunnel. He had said it would not. She allowed herself to think of the seashore again, and him. Whatever happened next, a wound deep within her was being healed. She could feel the scar tissue knitting. It had been the most expensive psychotherapy in the history of the world, and that's saying a lot, she thought. Debriefings were given to Xi and Sukhavati by representatives of their nations. Although Nigeria played no significant role in message acquisition or machine construction, Ada acquiesced readily enough to a long interview with Nigerian officials. But it was perfunctory compared with the interrogations administered to them by project personnel. Vege and Eli underwent still more elaborate debriefings by the high-level teams brought from the Soviet Union and the United States for this specific purpose. At first, these American and Soviet interrogations excluded foreign nationals, but after complaints were carried through the World Machine Consortium, the US and the SU relented, and the sessions were again internationalized. Kitz was in charge of her debriefing, and considering what short notice he must have been given, he had arrived surprisingly well prepared. Valerian and Dehir put in an occasional good word for her, and every now and then asked a searching question. But it was Kitz's show. He told her he was approaching her story skeptically but constructively in what he hoped was the best scientific tradition. He trusted she would not mistake the directness of his questions for some personal animus. He held her only in the greatest respect. He, in turn, would not permit his judgment to be clouded by the fact that he had been against the machine project from the beginning. She decided to let this pathetic deception pass unchallenged, and began her story. At first he listened closely, asked occasional questions of detail, and apologized when he interrupted. By the second day, no such courtesies were in evidence. So, the Nigerian is visited by his wife, the Indian by her dead husband, the Russian by his cute granddaughter, the Chinese by some Mongol warlord. Queen was not a Mongol. And you, for Christ's sake, you get visited by your dearly departed father, who tells you that he and his friends have been busy rebuilding the universe. Oh, for Christ's sake! Our Father who art in heaven, this is straight religion. This is straight cultural anthropology. This is straight Sigmund Freud. Don't you see that? Not only do you claim your own father came back from the dead, you actually expect us to believe that he made the universe. You're distorting what... Oh, come off it! Out of way! Don't insult our intelligence. You don't present us with a shred of evidence, and you expect us to believe the biggest cock and bull story of all time. Oh, no, you know better than that. You're a smart lady. How could you figure to get away with it? She protested. Valerian protested also. This kind of interrogation, he said, was a waste of time. The machine was undergoing sensitive physical tests at this moment. That was how the validity of her story could be checked. Kitz agreed the physical evidence would be important, but the nature of Arroway's story, he argued, was revealing. A means of understanding what had actually happened. Meeting your father in heaven and all that, Dr. Arroway, is telling, because you've been raised in the Judeo-Christian culture. You're essentially the only one of the five from that culture, and you're the only one who meets your father. Your story's just too pat. It's not imaginative enough. This was worse than she had thought possible. She felt a moment of epistemological panic, as when your car is not where you parked it, or the door you locked last night is ajar in the morning. She said, "You think we made all this up?" "Well, I'll tell you, Dr. Arroway, when I was very young, I worked in the Cook County Prosecutor's Office. When they were thinking about indicting somebody, they asked three questions." He ticked them off on his fingers. "Did he have the opportunity? Did he have the means? Did he have the motive?" "To do what?" she asked. He looked at her in disgust. "But our watches show that we'd been gone more than a day," she protested. "Oh, I don't know how I could have been so stupid," Kit said, striking his forehead with his palm. "You've demolished my argument. I forgot that it is impossible to set your watch ahead by a day." "But that implies a conspiracy. You think she lied? You think Ada lied? You think..." "What I think is we should move on to something more important. You know, Peter..." Kitz turned towards Valerian. "I'm persuaded you're right. A first draft of the materials assessment report will be here tomorrow morning. Now, let's not waste more time on stories. We'll adjourn till then. Tahir had said not a word throughout the entire afternoon session. He offered her an uncertain grin, and she couldn't help contrasting it with her father's. Sometimes Ken's expression seemed to urge her, to implore her. But to what end, she had no way of knowing. Perhaps to change her story. He had remembered her recollections of her childhood, and he knew how she had grieved for her father. Clearly, he was weighing the possibility that she'd gone crazy. By extension, she supposed, he was also considering the likelihood that the others had gone crazy too. Mass hysteria, shared delusion, fully sank. "Well, here it is," Kitz said. The report was about a centimetre thick. He let it fall to the table, scattering a few pencils. "You'll want to look through it, Dr. Arroway, but I can give you a quick summary, okay?" She nodded assent. She had heard through the grapevine that the report was highly favourable to the account the five had given. She hoped it would put an end to the nonsense. "The dodecahedron apparently," he laid great stress on this word, "has been exposed to a very different environment than the benzyls and the supporting structures. It's apparently been subjected to huge tensile and compressional stresses. It's a miracle the thing didn't fall to pieces. So, it's a miracle you and the others didn't fall to pieces at the same time. Also, it's apparently seen an intense radiation environment. There's low-level induced radioactivity, cosmic ray tracks, so on. It's another miracle that you survived the radiation. Nothing else has been added or taken away. There's no sign of erosion or scraping on the side vertices that you claim kept bumping into the walls of the tunnel. There's not even any scoring, as there would have been if it entered the Earth's atmosphere at high velocity." "So doesn't that confirm our story?" she said. "Oh, Michael, think about it. Tensile and compressional stresses. Tidal forces. And they are exactly what you expect if you fall down a classical black hole. Now, that's been known for 50 years at least. I don't know why we didn't feel it, but maybe the dodec protected us somehow. And high radiation doses from the inside of the black hole and from the environment of the galactic center, a known gamma-ray source. There's independent evidence for black holes, and there's independent evidence for a galactic center. We didn't make these things up. I don't understand the absence of scraping, but that depends on the interaction of a material that we've hardly studied with another material that's completely unknown. I wouldn't expect any scoring or charring because we don't claim we entered through the Earth's atmosphere. It seems to me the evidence almost entirely confirms our story. Now, what's the problem?" "The problem is you people are too clever. Too clever. Now look at it from the point of view of a skeptic. Step back and look at the big picture. There's a bunch of bright people in different countries who think the world is going to hell in a handbasket. They claim to receive a complex message from space." "Claim?" she said. "Let me continue. They decrypt the message and announce instructions on how to build a very complicated machine at a cost of trillions of dollars. The world's in a funny condition, the religions are all shaky about the oncoming millennium, and to everybody's surprise, the machine gets built. There's one or two slight changes in personnel, and then, essentially, these same people..." "It's not the same people," she shouted. "It's not Sukhavati, it's not Edda, it's not she, and there were..." "Let me continue," said Kitz. "Essentially, these same people then get to sit down in the machine. Because of the way the thing is designed, no one can see them, no one can talk to them after the thing is activated, so the machine is turned on, and then it turns itself off. Once it's on, you can't make it stop in less than 20 minutes. Okay. 20 minutes later, these same people emerged from the machine, all jolly jolly with some bullshit story about traveling faster than light inside black holes to the center of the galaxy and back. Now, suppose you hear this story, and you're just ordinarily cautious. You ask to see the evidence, pictures, videotapes, any other data. Guess what? It's all been conveniently erased. Do they have artifacts of this superior civilization they say is at the center of the galaxy? No. Mementos? No. A stone tablet? No. Pets? No. Nothing. The only physical evidence is some subtle damage done to the machine. So, you ask yourself, couldn't people who were so motivated and so clever arrange for what looks like tension stresses and radiation damage, especially if they could spend $2 trillion faking the evidence? She gasped. She remembered the last time she'd gasped. This was a truly venomous reconstruction of events. She wondered what had made it attractive to Kitts. He must, she thought, be in real distress. "I don't think anybody's going to believe your story," he continued. "This is the most elaborate and the most expensive hoax ever perpetrated. You and your friends tried to hoodwink the President of the United States and deceive the American people. To say nothing of all the other governments on the earth, you must really think everybody else is stupid." "Michael, this is madness," she said. "Tens of thousands of people worked to acquire the message, to decode it, and to build the machine. The message is on magnetic tapes and printouts and laser discs in observatories all over the world. You think there's a conspiracy involving all the radio astronomers on the planet and the aerospace and cybernetic companies? No, you don't need a conspiracy that big. All you need is a transmitter in space that looks as if it's broadcasting from Vega. I'll tell you how I think you did it. You prepare the message and you get somebody with an established launch capability to put it up, probably as an incidental part of some other mission, and into some orbit that looks like sidereal motion. Maybe there's more than one satellite. Then the transmitter turns on and you're already in your handy-dandy observatory to receive the message, make the big discovery, and tell us poor slobs what it all means." This was too much even for the impassive Dahir. He roused himself from a slumped position in his chair. "Oh, really, Mike," he began, but Ellie cut him short. "I wasn't responsible for most of the decoding. Lots of people were involved, Drumlin especially. He started out as a committed skeptic, as you know. But once the data came in, Dave was entirely convinced. You didn't hear any reservations from him." "Oh, yes. Poor Dave Drumlin," said Kitts. "The late Dave Drumlin. You set him up. The professor you never liked." Dahir slumped still further down in his chair, and she had a sudden vision of him, regaling Kitts with second-hand pillow talk. She looked at him more closely. She couldn't be sure. "During the decrypting of the message, you couldn't do everything. There was so much you had to do, so you overlooked this and you forgot that. Now here's Drumlin growing old, worried about his former student eclipsing him and getting all the credit. Suddenly he sees how to be involved, how to play a central role. You appealed to his narcissism and you hooked him. And if he hadn't figured out the decryption, you would have helped him along. If worst came to worst, you would have peeled all the layers off that onion yourself." "You're saying that we were able to invent such a message, really? It is an outrageous compliment to Vega and me. It's also impossible. It can't be done. You ask any competent engineer if that kind of machine, with brand new subsidiary industries, components wholly unfamiliar on Earth, you ask if that could have been invented by a few physicists and radio astronomers on their days off. When do you imagine we had time to invent such a message, even if we knew how? Look how many bits of information are in it. It would have taken years." "You had years," while Argus was getting nowhere. The project was about to be closed. Drumlin, you remember, was pushing that, so just at the right moment you find the message. Then there's no more talk about closing down your pet project. I think you and that Russian did cook the whole thing up in your spare time. You had years. This is madness, she said softly. Valerian interrupted. He had known Dr. Alloway well during the period in question, and she had done productive scientific work. She never had the time required for so elaborate a deception. Much as he admired her, he agreed that the message and the machine were far beyond her ability, or indeed anybody's ability, anybody on Earth. But Kitz wasn't buying it. That's a personal judgment, Valerian. There are many persons, and there can be many judgments. You're fond of Dr. Alloway, I understand. I'm fond of her, too. It's understandable. You would defend her. I don't take it amiss. But there's a clincher. You don't know about it yet. I'm going to tell you. He leaned forward, watching Ellie intently. Clearly he was interested to see how she would respond to what he was about to say. The message stopped the moment we activated the machine. The moment the Benzels reached cruising speed, to the second, all over the world, every radio observatory with a line of sight to Vega saw the same thing. We've held back telling you about it so we wouldn't distract you from your debriefing. The message stopped in mid-bit. Now that was really foolish of you. I don't know anything about it, Michael. But so what if the message stopped? It's fulfilled its purpose. We built the machine and we went to where they wanted us to go. It puts you in a peculiar position, he went on. Suddenly, she saw where he was headed. She hadn't expected this. He was arguing conspiracy, but she was contemplating madness. If Kitz wasn't mad, might she be? If our technology can manufacture substances that induce delusions, could a much more advanced technology induce highly detailed collective hallucinations? Just for a moment, it seemed possible. Let's imagine it's last week, he was saying. The radio waves arriving on Earth right now are supposed to have been sent from Vega 26 years ago. They take 26 years to cross space to us, but 26 years ago, Dr. Alloway, there wasn't any Argus facility, and you were sleeping with acid heads and moaning about Vietnam and Watergate. You people are so smart, but you forget the speed of light. There's no way that activating the machine can turn the message off until 26 years pass. Unless in ordinary space you can send a message faster than light. And we both know that's impossible. I remember you complaining about how stupid Rankin and Joss were for not knowing you can't travel faster than light. I'm surprised you thought you could get away with this one. She said, Michael, listen. It's how we were able to get from here to there and back in no time flat. 20 minutes, anyway. It can be a-causal around a singularity. I'm not an expert on this. You should be talking to Ada or Vega. Thank you for the suggestion, he said. We already have. She imagined Vega under some comparably stern interrogation by his old adversary, Arkhangelsky, or by Baruda, the man who had proposed destroying the radio telescopes and burning the data. Probably they and Kitz saw eye to eye on the awkward matter before them. She hoped Vega was bearing up all right. You understand, Dr. Alloway, and I'm sure you do, but let me explain again. Perhaps you can show me where I missed something. 26 years ago, those radio waves were heading out for Earth. Now imagine them in space between Vega and here. Nobody can catch the radio waves after they left Vega. Nobody can stop them. Even if the transmitter knew instantaneously, through the black hole, if you like, that the machine had been activated, it would be 26 years before the signal stops arriving on Earth. Your Vegans couldn't have known 26 years ago when the machine was going to be activated and to the minute. You would have to send a message back in time to 26 years ago for the message to stop on December 31st, 1999. You do follow, don't you? Yes, I follow. And this is wholly unexplored territory, she said. You know, it's not called a space-time continuum for nothing. If they can make tunnels through space, I suppose they can make some kind of tunnels through time. The fact that we got back a day early shows that they have at least a limited kind of time travel. So maybe, as soon as we left the station, they sent a message 26 years back into time to turn the transmission off. I don't know. You see how convenient it is for you that the message stops just now. I mean, if it was still broadcasting, we could find your little satellite, capture it, and bring back the transmission tape. Now that would be definitive evidence of a hoax, unambiguous, but you couldn't risk that. So you're reduced to black hole mumbo-jumbo. Probably embarrassing for you. He looked concerned. It was like some paranoid fantasy into which a patchwork of innocent facts are reassembled into an intricate conspiracy. The facts in this case were hardly commonplace, and it made sense for the authorities to test other possible explanations. But Kitz's rendition of events was so malign that it revealed, she thought, someone truly wounded, afraid, in pain. In her mind, the likelihood that all this was a collective delusion diminished a little, but the cessation of the message transmission, if it had happened, as Kitz had said, was worrisome. Now, I tell myself, Dr. Arroway, you scientists had the brains to figure all this out and the motivation, but by yourselves you didn't have the means. If it wasn't the Russians who put up this satellite for you, it could have been any one of half a dozen other national launch authorities. But we've looked into all that. Nobody launched a free-flying satellite in the appropriate orbits. That leaves private launch capability, and the most interesting possibility that's come to our notice is a Mr. S. R. Haddon. You know him? Oh, don't be ridiculous, Michael. I talked to you about Haddon before I went up in Methuselah. Just wanted to be sure that we agree on the basics. Now try this on for size. You and the Russian concoct this scheme. You get Haddon to bankroll the early stages, the satellite design, the invention of the machine, the encrypting of the message, faking the radiating damage, all that. In return, after the machine project gets going, he gets to play with some of that $2 trillion. He likes the idea. There might be enormous profit in it, and from his history, well, he'd love to embarrass the government. When you get stuck in decrypting the message, when you can't find the primer, you even go to him. He tells you where to look for it. Now, that was also careless. It would have been better if you'd figured it out for yourself. It's too careless, offered De Gea. Wouldn't someone who was really perpetrating a hoax... Ken, I'm surprised at you. You've been very credulous, you know. You're demonstrating exactly why Arroway and the others thought it would be clever to ask Haddon's advice and to make sure we knew that she'd gone to see him. He returned his attention to her. Dr. Arroway, try to look at it from the standpoint of a neutral observer. He pressed on, making sparkling new patterns of facts assemble themselves in the air before her, rewriting whole years of her life. She hadn't ever thought Kitz dumb, but she hadn't imagined him this inventive either. Perhaps he had received help, but the emotional propulsion for this fantasy came from Kitz. He was full of expansive gestures and rhetorical flourishes. This was not merely part of his job, this interrogation, this alternative interpretation of events, had aroused something passionate in him. After a moment, she thought she saw what it was. The five had come back with no immediate military application, no politically liquid capital, but only a story that was surpassing strange. And that story had certain implications. Kitts was now master of the most devastating arsenal on Earth, while the caretakers were building galaxies. He was a lineal descendant of a progression of leaders, American and Soviet, who had devised the strategy of nuclear confrontation, while the caretakers were an amalgam of diverse species from separate worlds working together in concert. Their very existence was an unspoken rebuke. Then consider the possibility that the tunnel could be activated from the other end, that there might be nothing he could do to prevent it. They could be here in an instant. Well, how could Kitts defend the United States under such circumstances? His role in the decision to build the machine, the history of which he seemed to be actively rewriting, could be interpreted by an unfriendly tribunal as dereliction of duty. And what account could Kitts give the extraterrestrials of his stewardship of the planet, he and his predecessors? Even if no avenging angels came storming out of the tunnel, if the truth of the journey got out, the world would change. It was already changing. It would change much more. Again she regarded him with sympathy. For 100 generations at least, the world had been run by people much worse than he. It was his misfortune to come to bat just as the rules of the game were being rewritten. Even if you believed every detail of your story, he was saying, don't you think the extraterrestrials treated you badly? They take advantage of your tenderest feelings by dressing themselves up as dear old dad. They don't tell you what they're doing. They expose all your film, destroy all your data, and don't even let you leave that stupid palm frond up there. Nothing on the manifest is missing except for a little food, and nothing that isn't on the manifest is returned except for a little sand. So, in 20 minutes you gobbled some food and dumped a little sand out of your pockets. You come back 1 nanosecond or something after you leave, so to any neutral observer you never left at all. Now, if the extraterrestrials wanted to make it unambiguously clear that you'd really gone somewhere, they wouldn't have brought you back, or till a day later, or a week, right? If there was nothing inside the Benzels for a while, we'd be dead certain that you'd gone somewhere. If they wanted to make it easy for you, they wouldn't have turned off the message, right? That makes it look bad, you know. They could have figured that out. Why would they want to make it bad for you? And there's other ways. They could have supported your story. They could have given you something to remember them by. They could have let you bring back your movies, and then nobody would claim all this is just a clever fake. So how come they didn't do that? How come the extraterrestrials don't confirm your story? You spent years of your life trying to find them. Don't they appreciate what you've done? Ellie, how can you be so sure your story really happened? If, as you claim, all this isn't a hoax, couldn't it be a delusion? Now, it's painful to consider, I know. Nobody wants to think they've gone a little crazy. And considering the strain you've been under, though, it's no big deal. And if the only alternative is criminal conspiracy, well, maybe you want to carefully think this one through. She had already done so. Later that day, she met with Kitts alone. A bargain had, in effect, been proposed. She had no intention of going along with it, but Kitts was prepared for that possibility as well. "You never liked me from the first," he said, "but I'm going to rise above that. We're going to do something really fair. We've already issued a new release saying that the machine just didn't work when we tried to activate it. Naturally, we're trying to understand what went wrong. With all the other failures in Wyoming and Uzbekistan, nobody's doubting this one. Then, in a few weeks, we'll announce that we're still not getting anywhere. We've done the best we could. The machine is too expensive to keep working on. Probably we're just not smart enough to figure it out yet. Also, there's still some danger. After all, we always knew that. The machine might blow up or something. So, all in all, it's best to put the machine project on ice, at least for a while. And it's not that we didn't try. Haddon and his friends would oppose it, of course, but as he's been taken from us... He's only 300 kilometers overhead, she pointed out. Oh, Haven't you heard? Saul died just around the time the machine was activated. Funny how it happened. Oh, sorry, I would have told you. I forgot you were close to him. She didn't know whether to believe Kitts. Haddon was in his 50s and had certainly seemed in good physical health. She would pursue this topic later. "And what, in your fantasy, becomes of us?" she asked. "Us? Who's us?" "Us," she said, "the five of us, the ones who went aboard the machine that you claim never worked." "Oh, after a little more debriefing, you'll be free to leave. And I don't think any of you will be foolish enough to tell this cock-and-bull story on the outside. But just to be safe, we're preparing some psychiatric dossiers on the five of you, profiles, low-key. You've always been a little rebellious, mad at the system, whichever system you grew up in. It's okay. It's good for people to be independent. We encourage that, especially in scientists. But the strain of the last few years has been trying. Not actually disabling, but trying. Especially for Doctors Arroway and Lunacarsky. First, they're involved in finding the message, decrypting it, and convincing the government to build the machine. Then problems in construction, industrial sabotage, sitting through an activation that goes nowhere. It's been tough. All work, no play. And scientists are highly strung, anyway. Now, if you've all become a little unhinged at the failure of the machine, everybody will be sympathetic, understanding. But nobody will believe your story. Nobody. If you behave yourselves, there's no reason that the dossiers will ever have to be released. It'll be clear that the machine is still here. We're having a few wire service photographers in to photograph it as soon as the roads are open. We'll show them that the machine didn't go anywhere. And the crew, well, the crew is naturally disappointed. Maybe a little disheartened. They don't want to talk to the press just yet. Now, don't you think that's a neat plan? He smiled. He wanted her to acknowledge the beauty of the scheme. She said nothing. Don't you think we're being very reasonable after spending $2 trillion on that pile of shit? We could put you away for life, Arroway, but we're letting you go free. You don't even have to put up bail. I think we're behaving like gentlemen. It's the spirit of the millennium. It's Mackindo.